There will come a day when we stop talking about the trade war. Today, however, is not that day. From American Public Media, this is Market Flash. In Los Angeles, I'm Kyle Risdahl. It is Monday, the 4th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The State of the Union is tomorrow night. There may or may not be another government shutdown in 11 days, but for at least one member of Congress, the trade war is still front and center. Republican Congresswoman Jackie Walorski represents Indiana's 2nd congressional district, a big center for manufacturing in this country and this economy, and so hit hard by the president's steel and aluminum tariffs. So she's been keeping a key eye on the tariff exemption process the Department of Commerce set up, lo these many months ago. That's why we talked to her back in August, and it's why we got her back on the phone today. Congresswoman, welcome to the program, ma'am.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the call.
Let me first of all get the trade vibe from the Indiana 2nd. What's the word from back home?
Well, you know, I think we've made some progress, and I think we have a long way to go. I'm going to stay very, paying attention to every detail here and continuing to fight for fairness when it comes to trade, where we're going, where we've come from, and kind of like what's ahead. You know, I support the president, and I think what he's doing is valid.
Right.
I just think there's times when, you know, we've got to really make sure that we're providing the oversight that's needed in things like holding the Commerce Department's feet to the fire with exclusion processes and rebuttals and those kinds of things that we've been able to accomplish. I do think there have been some, you know, bumps along the way, and that's what we're paying attention to, is if somebody gets in trouble because there's no supply, they shouldn't be penalized. We should fix it and move on.
Let me ask you about the Commerce Department first of all. There's a bunch of things I want to talk about, but let's talk about commerce and the exclusions. That is, you know, the way American companies can get some of the stuff they need if their incoming products are tariffed. You've been doing a lot of work on this. Your office has, your chief of staff has. Are you satisfied that, first of all, the exclusion or the exemption process for these tariffs is robust enough for what's going on? And how worried are you about these new tariffs conceivably coming on the 2nd of March if the president and President Xi of China don't come to some kind of deal?
Yeah, you know, that's continued to be an issue. And from the beginning of this, there's been companies waiting almost 300 days for an answer when they've gone through the current process that Commerce uses. We've been involved, my office and myself, in straightening that out and, you know, finding a much fairer, clearer, less burdensome way to do this. But, you know, the frustration tends to be growing. And, you know, we're doing our job and we're taking information from around the country and really being a mouthpiece for the nation right now, sending out a newsletter
yeah.
for people that really want to dig in the weeds here. And it's really been an educational piece to help people be able to survive this.
So I'll tell you, we were talking to a guy, and I can't remember where he was, but he was definitely not in the Indiana 2nd Congressional District. He was quite a ways away. And he said, yeah, I get this email from Congresswoman Walorski's chief of staff. And we were like, oh, we ought to call. But look, so here's the deal, ma'am. Even though you are a Republican, you say you support the president, your district favors the president, when you go home, are people grabbing you on the street corners and say, Jackie, what are you doing to us? You're killing us.
No, you know what?
Really?
We have a very open policy when it comes to communication. I have not been bashful. I'm very vocal and very visible about what I believe in working on behalf of the folks that are job creators in my district and really around the country to say, you may not have an advocate here, but here's exactly what's happening and why it's important for you. And here's what we're going to be doing next, because we're trying to bring the mountains down in front of you. And we're trying to make sure that we don't lose jobs and that we, you know, treat our American companies fairly.
So where's the line, ma'am? If tariffs go up to 25% on a whole nother couple of $100 billion worth of stuff from the Chinese economy, what are you going to do? Where's your line?
Well, I'm going to remain positive right now. The ongoing talks between U.S. and China, I'll do my part to make sure that we have a long-term resolution. And I do believe at the end we will work this out, but we're going to maintain our vigilance.
Congresswoman Jackie Walorski from the Indiana 2nd. Ma'am, thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
One of the last big issues from the financial crisis, arguably, is what to do about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two big government-backed housing finance companies that have been in conservatorship since they almost went under back in 2008. Lawmakers have tried a bunch of times in the past 10 years to get them, and by extension, I guess, the government, out of the mortgage business. Hasn't worked, obviously, but Idaho Senator Mike Crapo, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, is going to take another whack at privatizing Fannie and Freddie and opening the housing finance market to private competition. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains why he's doing that and why it matters.
One big reason Fannie and Freddie are still under government control?
I think the expression is nobody wants to get blamed for breaking the housing market.
That's Guy Sakala, publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance.
That's been true since the recession, but it's certainly true now. The housing market is somewhat precarious.
And there's the genuine disagreement about how to fix the system. Generally speaking, Sakala says Republican lawmakers favor substantially reducing Fannie and Freddie's power and the risk to taxpayers by opening the market for guaranteeing mortgages to private competition. Democrats want to preserve Fannie and Freddie's government mandate to promote affordable housing. Since 1992, the companies have been required to buy a certain percentage of mortgages that benefit low-income families.
The current mandates are things that must happen that the regulator has power to enforce.
Nikitra Bailey is with the Center for Responsible Lending. She says Senator Crapo's proposal would replace those mandates with what she calls untested incentives to encourage private investment in affordable housing.
And we just believe firmly that it's important to preserve what we know works well.
With Democrats in control of the House and a narrow Republican majority in the Senate, some compromise might be possible. Jesse Van Tol is CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He says if Congress can't agree, the Trump administration is due out with its own plan to privatize Fannie and Freddie.
The administration has both the authority and apparently the desire to take some meaningful steps. I think the question is, how far will they go?
Last week, the White House said it plans to work with Congress on reform. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it's going to be the happy music when we get there. There's corporate acquisition news today, and it comes on four wheels. Tesla has offered to buy a company called Maxwell Technologies for a couple of $100 million, $218 million in stock, to be precise. Maxwell's got some interesting battery technology, which makes it a logical target for Tesla, right? Whose products are, of course, battery powered. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that one.
Tesla is already pretty gosh darn good at making batteries, but it can't rest on its laurels, says Daniel Ives, a managing director at Wedbush Securities.
Right now, there's an arms race going on in the EV market.
EV, electric vehicles.
And Tesla's in a position of strength, but they can't just sit back and watch competition narrow the gap. In 2019, 2020, you're going to see more and more automakers going after the EV market.
This acquisition differs from Tesla's usual approach, trying to develop technology itself, says Colin Rush, a managing director at Oppenheimer.
The time frame for developing it is unrealistic, and then the IP protection around the process would be very hard to avoid.
Rush says a key motivator for Tesla is reducing the cost of its cars. And Maxwell's technology will help it make batteries faster and cheaper.
And the biggest cost component of an electric vehicle is the battery at about 40% as they move into the lower cost vehicles.
Rush says cost is one of the biggest barriers to EV sales.
And if manufacturers are able to reduce the cost, the number of people that can afford to buy electric vehicles will increase.
Maxwell's technology will likely have some performance benefits for Tesla, too. Anna Stefanopoulou is the director of the Energy Institute at the University of Michigan.
It would improve the power capabilities. You'd be able to strip energy and push back energy really fast.
Which means faster charging and acceleration. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If you were watching the Super Bowl last night, I mean the ads, of course, because the game, whatever, you probably noticed that Bud Light used some of the most expensive ad time in the history of television to say that its beer does not contain corn syrup.
My king, this corn syrup was just delivered.
That's not ours. We don't brew Bud Light with corn syrup.
Miller Lite uses corn syrup.
Miller wasn't happy. It shot back that Bud Light's parent company, Anheuser-Busch InBev, uses corn syrup in plenty of its other beers. The National Corn Growers Association objected, too. Most of the rest of us, though, were stuck on the corn syrup in beer thing. Marketplace's Justin Ho has the explanation.
When it comes down to it, beer has four ingredients.
Barley,
water, hops, and yeast.
That's John Palmer, who literally wrote the book on homebrewing called How to Brew. He says for centuries, brewers have used grains other than barley. Palmer says brewers use rice and corn because they want to make a different kind of beer.
They have less protein than barley. And so you produce a lighter-bodied, less filling beer by using them.
The Bud Light ad isn't talking about corn, though. It's calling out corn syrup. Palmer says there's only one real difference between syrup and the grain itself.
It's mainly a question of economics for the brewer. Most breweries use the already processed syrup because it's more convenient.
And they've been doing it for decades. Anthony Manuel is the head of brewing at Molson and Miller Coors. He says his company does use corn syrup in Miller Lite and Miller High Life.
So it can be used in heavier beers to make them a little bit lighter. And it can be used in light beers like Miller Lite and Coors Light in order to reduce calories and carbohydrate.
Or to give it a little more kick, says Yepa Yanabieso, the owner of Evil Twin Brewing. That's a medium-sized brewery with locations in Denmark and New York.
And that's why it makes sense for some big breweries to use it, because they have to make the beers as cheap as possible, and malt is more expensive than corn sugar.
As a smaller brewer, he says he can charge a premium price for a bottle of beer. But Bud and Miller Coors don't have that option. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Facebook turns 15 today, and while one can argue that its corporate behavior is age-appropriate for human teenagers, think about it, we got to thinking about the social networks that have come and gone, or at least aren't used as much, in the decade and a half since Mark Zuckerberg was sitting there in his dorm room at Harvard. We asked you on Friday to share your comments about the social media of the past, what you used, what you didn't use, how it has changed your life. We got emails about AOL Messenger, LiveJournal, Internet Relay Chat, and something called Fido Mail, whatever that is. Also, we got these two voice memos. First, Mark Cathcart in Louisville, Colorado, and then Enrique Sandoval down in San Antonio, Texas.
We used to use a website called Friends Reunited, which in the UK was massive in the early 2000s. And for one reason or another, disappeared completely over the next 14, 15 years and has gone now. Twitter was brilliant when it first launched because I worked in the tech industry then. But I think what most people who use Twitter these days forget is that Twitter, when it first launched, was a great way of getting around using text messages to communicate, which were chargeable back then. Everyone had to pay for text messages, but you could send free texts to Twitter and it would send you the tweets as texts.
Back when I was young, in middle school or so, I had a girlfriend. She was my first girlfriend. And in the seventh grade, her parents were moving to Chicago. Then fast forward many years later, you know, after college and whatnot, I get a message on MySpace that said, if you're so-and-so, then if not, don't worry about it. But if you are, hey, how you been? And we started conversing there. Many years later, now we've been married for almost 10 years and three beautiful daughters.
Mark Cathcart in Louisville, Enrique Sandoval in San Antonio down in Texas. Weigh in. We'll just see what others said and send us your own experiences with social media of times gone by. You can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Reporters, and I include myself, we're vain creatures. We're a particular kind of tribe.
Taking a long, hard look in the journalism business mirror. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 0.7% today, 175 points, 25,239 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 1.1%, 83 points, 73.47. The S&P 500 gained 0.6%, 18 points, ended things at 27.24. Alphabet reported mixed results in its profit statement today. Shares were up about 2% before the market closed. They slid a bit, though, after hours. Apple briefly became the world's most valuable company. Again, today Microsoft quickly regained that title and ended the day with its shares up more than 2%. Apple gained nearly 3% on the day. Healthcare not so good today. Allergan woke up to bad news about its blockbuster Botox treatment. A competitor drug got FDA approval. Allergan shares down nearly 4%. United Health down 0.25%. Johnson & Johnson lost 1% as well. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury up to 2.72%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We are 70 days from tax day right now. 70 days left to figure out what is what in this, the first filing season under the new 2017 tax code. It lowered taxes for a lot of people and companies, as you know, but it also changed the tax code to make up for some of that lost revenue. And one of those changes has to do with how much you pay in taxes when you are awarded money in a lawsuit or legal settlement. Marketplace's Mario Segura has that story.
Last year, Brian Vastag got a big legal settlement. Vastag used to be a reporter for the Washington Post. He wrote about science.
You know, astronomy and space and dinosaurs and human evolution.
Then in 2012, when he was in his early 40s, he got sick with chronic fatigue syndrome. He eventually had to stop working.
I was basically bedbound for most of 2013 and part of 2014. It was very hard for me to get out of the house and do anything.
Vastag filed a claim with his company's disability insurance provider, Prudential, and it was denied. So he hired a lawyer, sued, won, and then got an additional settlement. But that pile of money shrank quickly. First, he had to pay his lawyer. She was working on contingency. And lawyer's fees can run up to 30, 40, even 50%.
So, you know, the settlement I got from Prudential, the attorney's fees never touched my bank account. I never saw that money.
Then came the taxes. And this is when he got a pretty big shock. His accountant told him that under the 2017 tax reform law, he'd have to pay taxes on the entire settlement, including the part that went straight from the insurance company to his lawyer.
It makes it harder for me to have a stable financial plan. It's a big hit, and it was a hit I wasn't expecting I'd have to take.
So look, taxes are complicated, and there is a lot of fine print here. But let's just say, before 2018, if you had to pay taxes on a legal settlement or money you got in a lawsuit, you generally didn't have to pay taxes on the part of it that went to your lawyer. Now, with just a few exceptions, you do. Rob Wood is a tax lawyer in California. He represents a lot of clients who get settlements.
I think disbelief is probably the, you know, the biggest reaction.
Wood says this change applies to a seemingly endless list of cases.
You sue somebody for defamation. You sue a stockbroker or financial advisor for bad advice. You sue your neighbor for trespass. You sue the police for false arrest.
And having to pay taxes on lawyers' fees can make a big difference, especially for people who are relying on settlement money to make them whole, like Elijah Armstrong. He's 22, and he's a student at Penn State. He went to high school in Jacksonville, Florida, where he ran into a problem. The lights in his math class kept flickering.
I am a photosensitive epileptic, and that caused me to have seizures.
He couldn't get the school to move the class or fix the problem in another way. So eventually he sued, and later, after graduating, got an $80,000 settlement. A third of that went to his lawyer. But this was before the new tax law, and he didn't have to pay taxes on that third, which was a big deal because he had bills to pay from that time in his life.
Hospital bills, there were another set of lawyers that I had to pay for, and then I come from a single-parent household, and my mom had to take off work to take me to the hospital. Like, the goal was to break even. Because I had lost so much money.
Breaking even could be even harder now for people who have to pay taxes on their lawyer's fees. I'm Marielle Segura for Marketplace.
We're barely a month in, and 2019 has already been a rough year for media companies. Gannett, the biggest newspaper publisher in the country, has laid off 400 people. BuzzFeed, McClatchy, and Huffington Post got hundreds of jobs in January. And just last Friday, Vice Media announced it's cutting 10% of its staff. Timely, then, that Jill Abramson, who used to be the executive editor of the New York Times, has a new book out on the business of news. Disagreements with a publisher of the Times about exactly that, how to transform the paper in the digital age, was at the heart of why she lost her job back in 2014. Her new book, it's part memoir, part investigative narrative about the changes in the media business model, driven specifically by BuzzFeed, Vice, The New York Times, and The Washington Post, is called Merchants of Truth. Jill Abramson, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Why these four companies in this book? What was it about them?
Well, I wanted to pick four companies that all illustrated somewhat different crises. And when I started my reporting, Vice and BuzzFeed were the shiny new stars. Vice said it was going to shove CNN, you know, off the map. And, you know, BuzzFeed was seen as competition to the Times and the Post because it had built a huge audience using Facebook.
So when did you – well, we'll get to Facebook in a minute, actually. But when did you start reporting this book? Because as anybody who's been following the news of the news business knows, the bloom is kind of off the rose for Vice. And, you know, BuzzFeed just had those big layoffs. So it's not, you know, clear sailing for them by any means.
Vice and BuzzFeed, you're right, are having layoffs. Mm. And their news divisions seem to be in crisis. But with the Trump bump and digital subscriptions going up at both the Times and the Post, they're more secure. I mean, the Post is owned by Jeff Bezos, mm-hmm. who's given them a long runway to regain their glory days. You know, the Times is feeling good and hiring people and, you know, expand in all kinds of ways.
A word here about Facebook, since I mentioned it. I'm reading the table of contents here, and you've got chapters titled BuzzFeed 1, Vice 1, New York Times 1, and then you go on and on, BuzzFeed, Vice, New York Times, Washington Post, Vice, BuzzFeed. And then, boom, out of nowhere, chapter 9 is Facebook. Why Facebook in a story about the news business?
Well, because Facebook is the news business. You know,
okay,
it
sorry.
Does
let me,
not.
Let me just, that's slightly horrifying.
Yeah, it horrifies me. That's for sure. Facebook has become the dominant distributor of news stories. It's effectively the biggest publisher ever known to man. So I thought Facebook needed to be all together.
I want to talk about metrics for a minute. We can now measure what news people are consuming to the nth degree. The Post, as you point out in this book, has had, you know, big screens in its newsroom about
right.
who's clicking on what. Good thing or a bad thing for the business of news?
Well, you know, I think it's both. You know, why should editors, when the tool of something like Chartbeat is around, not know what news is most interesting to their readers or audiences? But I fear that reporters, and I include myself, we're vain creatures. We're a particular kind of tribe. And, you know, a Times journalist I saw recently admitted to me that when he's not writing about Trump and Trump isn't in his headline, he doesn't get the traffic. So, you know, it fuels and skews coverage in a way that's worrisome. Hmm.
Jill Abramson, formerly of The Wall Street Journal, also The New York Times, and now a new book called Merchants of Truth. Jill, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
I enjoyed the conversation, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, if you use Slack at work or elsewhere in your life for some reason, you either love it or you hate it. I am more on the not exactly love it side. But however you feel about it, you will soon-ish have a chance to put your money where your mouth is. The company announced today it has filed a confidential application with the Securities and Exchange Commission to list its shares publicly. You'll notice I didn't say file for an IPO, initial public offering, the usual way that companies go public. A direct listing lets companies list directly. Without having big banks underwrite the offering, it does tend, however, to be a bit more volatile that way. out of here. Dow Industrials up 0.7% today, about 175 points. NASDAQ up 1.1%, 83 points. S&P 500 up 0.6%. That is 18 points on that particular index. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.